OutOfSight.net presents best-selling author Nelson DeMille, hosted by Rich DeStenno at our 9th birthday celebration, January 28th, 2017.
This is Rich DeStenno from Out of Sight, and I have here on the line, very honored to have with us, the great author and someone many of us have read much of and enjoyed much of, Nelson DeMille. Nelson, thank you so much for coming. Welcome to the group.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you for inviting me.
In preparation, I looked at various interviews that you did, and I listened to some of them. I went on your website. I've read many of your books. And from what I gather, you were born and raised, at least partly early in your life, raised in Jamaica, Queens. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
And then you moved to Long Island. I know you went to Hofstra, and then you were in the Vietnam War, right?
Right, that's right.
The John Corey series. Now, I know it started with Plum Island, and you went on to a bunch of them. Could you give us just an idea of how it came about that you even thought of that character and what he consists of?
Yeah, you know, I had never done a series before. You know, you're familiar with my writing, and I guess everybody else listening is. All my books are what they call standalones, and I like the series format, but I never did it myself. And Plum Island, the first of the John Corey series, was actually not meant to be a series. I was just fishing around for an idea, and I was looking for a character who was politically incorrect, who could be outrageous, but lovable, which is a hard task. And so I came up with John Corey. But the plot had to do with Plum Island, which is here at the end of Long Island. I had, it's kind of interesting, I had two idea folders, which I keep. One had to do with Captain Kidd's buried treasure, which was buried someplace off the eastern tip of Long Island on one of the smaller islands. And the other idea I always had was to do a book about Plum Island, which is now run by the Department of Agriculture, actually now run by Homeland Security. But what they did there was animal disease research, but it was always thought to be a biological warfare research center. And I never developed either of the ideas. And then one day, I guess the muse struck, and I decided to put these two ideas together, Plum Island and Captain Kidd's treasure. So I had my plot, and then I had my character of John Corey, NYPD, who was convalescing on leave after being shot in line of duty, and he's out on the east end of Long Island. And it all just came together. It's one of those, you know, one of those serendipitous things where your character and your plot, in this case two plots, all came together. And that was Plum Island, and it was, you know, wildly successful, I have to say. And I was, you know, really happy with that. But then I went on to another book, The Lion's Game, not thinking of anything about series, but the fan mail was so overwhelming, not to mention the sales, but the fan mail had to do with not so much my clever plot, but it had to do with the character of John Corey. So my publisher called me one day and said, look, why don't we bring back John Corey? And so I said, well, okay. And I said, but I'm not used to doing series. I don't know how to, you know, really integrate one book into the other and that type of thing. But I realized I had hit on something with this character of John Corey, so that's how the series developed from a standalone book.
Well, somebody had recommended Plum Island to me. I had not read any of your books at that time, and when I began that book, and he was sitting there on the back porch of that house on Long Island, and somebody came to him to try to get him out of retirement or disability, I'm not sure which it was, but to get him back in business to investigate. I mean, the sarcasm and, you know, the attitude, it was just like so funny and so interesting. I was really hooked on John Corey at that point. I knew I had to read all the books.
Oh, thanks, Rich. And, you know, having lived in New York, that's kind of a New York mouth, and certainly a NYPD mouth. So.
Absolutely. I just totally related to it. Just to backtrack a second, I know from the various things I've read that you write your books in longhand, on pencil, on paper. Is that still the case?
That's correct. I'm sitting on my desk right now with a legal pad in front of me and a batch of number one pencils and an electric pencil sharpener.
Now, do you tear off each page and make a stack, or how do you do that?
Yeah, I tear off each page, and then I, you know, reread it a couple of times, and I give it to my long-suffering typist assistant who has to read my handwriting, and she puts it in a type form. And sometimes I play with it on a computer in type form.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times I'll just do pencil editing on the type page, and she'll retype it. Usually it's about five drafts, three handwritten and two, maybe three, type drafts, and then I'm kind of okay with it.
That's another thing I was wondering about, how many drafts you have to do. And in those cases, how much of the final product is the result of the publisher requesting certain types of changes?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it varies from book to book and editor to editor. Some editors are more aggressive than others, and some of them have some good ideas, but the editorial process is a give and take, and but I can usually get away with whatever I want to get away with. But if I get a good idea, I will, I'll go with it from, good editorial idea or plot idea. But maybe, I mean, to give you a percentage, maybe 5% of the book is really as a result of the editing process.
Oh, great. So you really, at this point, you pretty much get your product to market.
Yeah, exactly.
You said something in one of the interviews I heard on YouTube that it was really funny, but I can really see the truth of this. You said your job basically amounts to sitting alone in a room and telling yourself stories.
That's exactly what I'm doing right now. On a Saturday, I'm in my office. I keep an office out of the house because you can't get anything done at home.
Yeah.
And, my office, my writing office, is away in the same building but away from where my assistant sits, so we don't interact during the day. And I don't get phone calls, I don't have a computer here, and I have no distractions. I have basically a pot of coffee and a desk that I work at and my pencils and pencil sharpener and paper. And it works for me. I mean, everybody writes differently. I mean, my friend Harlan Coben, whose stuff you may have read,
yeah,
he says he does a lot of his writing on his iPad in a Starbucks. And,
wow, it's completely different, right?
Completely different. And Mary Higgins Clark is a good friend. She says she gets up at early, like 5:30, and has a cup of tea or something. And she writes early morning, and she wants to be done by lunch. I'm a night writer. I usually get to my desk more like 12 o'clock, about noon, and I write till 7, 8, or 9 o'clock. If I'm on deadline, I'll go to midnight. So it's a different process. If you can ask 20 authors, and I don't think any of them even have the same, nothing seems to overlap. Everybody's got something different. Certainly I handwrite, that's very different. And some people like quiet, some people like music, some people can write on the airplane, some people can write anywhere. I can only write at this desk, and that's where I am now.
Do you try to stick to a schedule, like, say, 5 days a week, 8 hours a day, or you just, whenever you feel that you have an idea to put down, you're going to do it?
No, you have to stay to a schedule. If you think you don't have an idea, too bad, you got to sit down. I usually get to my office at 9, and I do 2 or 3 hours of, emails and bills like everybody else with my assistant, and we answer fan mail when we can and look at, foreign rights contracts from Bulgaria or whatever you got to do. There's a business end of it. But 12 o'clock, I'm in my other room and at my desk. And whether anything is coming or not, I sit here. And eventually it'll come.
Yeah.
Because you realize you're not allowed to get up until 7 o'clock at night anyway. So you might as well do something while you're there. And that's my schedule. And but at the end, when the book is due and maybe a little bit behind, like the term paper that we've all waited to the last minute for, then I'll stay till midnight, and my record is 4 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
I came in on Sunday once about noon, and I wrote until 4 a.m. Monday morning and went home, and then came back to the office not too much later. All of us who write, whether it be in college or whatever, know that we put it off if we can, and we have to do it all at the end. So, I mean, I think 50% of my writing is done in the last 10% of the allotted time.
Well, that raises an interesting point about deadlines by publishers. I suppose then when a book is planned, they do give you a deadline that is somewhat flexible. Is that true?
It's a little flexible. I mean, you know, every contract is different. I have 14 months in my publishing contract. And I should say here, not every author is writing with a contract. I write because I'm under contract. You know, I've accepted an offer from a publisher, and in good faith, I try to keep to the contract. Some authors write on speculation. They don't want a contract. They want to be able to really do it when they want, how they want, and turn a full book in. I only turn in a 10-page outline. The publisher says, fine, or let's work on this, and do you have a better idea? And then once you agree on the idea, that's all they've seen. They've seen the 10-page, 15-page, I call it an outline, it's really a memo. And then you go with it. And the publishers with big books would like to have a spring book or a fall book. It's nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
Spring book is, you know, usually from about, let's say, Easter, Passover, till about Father's Day in June. And after that, no big books will be published until kind of end of September, and that's the fall and holiday season. And no big books are usually published January, February, or March. There are exceptions. John Grisham, for many years, liked his books to come out in January, and why, I have no idea. I don't think he's still on that schedule. But, you know, you can overthink these things. You try to strategize when's the best time for your book to come out and what's happening. And as a good for instance, you know, in this past fall, we had a presidential election that consumed everybody's psychic energy, and this was not a good fall to bring a book out.
Yeah,
a lot
I can
of
imagine.
Were, oh my God, a lot of, especially, I mean, fiction authors were really unhappy that the books were coming out this past fall. That happened to me once in a presidential election year, and you know what, it didn't affect sales that much, although it did, but it's not so much the sales. You want to not be competing with people's time and attention when something else is happening. And some of the stuff is on schedule, like, you know, war and earthquake and, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Some is scheduled like presidential election. So, you know, it's a business. I try not to think of it as a business, but ultimately it is a business, and that's the way the publishers think of it.
Well, that's a really interesting insight into the business side of it, because I'm sure you probably realize that most readers never even think about that part of it.
No, they probably never do. But I mean, I think the ultimate goal is to bring the best book to as many people as possible. And if you don't think in terms of sales, but you think in terms of just wanting people to read, and that's why I always support the tapes for, you know, visually impaired, and we don't, you know, there's never any charge for that. The publishers and the authors are more than happy to do that, and Braille, and any other format that we think that increase the readership without increasing sales revenue. It's not that important. The really important thing is that you get as many readers as possible, because the theory is, and it's true, that, you know, readers who've read it, who read it from a borrowed book, let's say, will recommend that author to somebody else who's going to go out and buy it. So if you get obsessed with sales, it's not good. And you want to be obsessed with having people read what you wrote, and you're trying to write the best book you can.
Well, we have, fortunately, as blind and physically handicapped people, we have a wealth of books at our disposal from the National Library Service. And in the last few years, with the technology, they're downloadable right from the website, and it's such a fast process now that we can be pretty much up on even newer books, you know, as opposed to before when it actually took a year or two to even see a book.
Yes. I know. It's, and then there's the large print editions, and again, I say other, you know, with the technology, we have other formats, and I think it's terrific, because I get a lot of fan mail from people who are visually impaired, and they've read, you know, they've listen, usually listen to the book in one form or another, either the commercial version or another version. And even with the Kindle, you can make the type much bigger, and that's great for people who can read, you know, bigger type.
Right.
You know, it's out there, and the audios are good. You know, I've listened to a number of them, and they really are well done.
Yeah, I'm impressed with some of the narrators are really incredible. I just want to touch on a couple of your books that are probably, I would have to say, are particular favorites of mine, and I had some interesting thoughts about them to ask you. One book that kind of scares you, if you really think of it as real, and I think in your comments prior, in the early part of the book, the beginning of the book, you said, and I'm talking about Wildfire, your book Wildfire, you said you didn't know if such a process agreed, such a plan existed as Wildfire, but perhaps it should. So could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I guess you have to, you know, go back to what it was about, but I won't waste too much time on it. But, you know, we all remember, not maybe all of us, but of a certain age remember the, I guess they call it the strategy of mutually assured destruction.
Right.
That if the old Soviet Union were to launch nuclear missiles at America, we would launch all ours back. So you can see this visual image of Russian missiles coming toward us and us going toward them, crossing in the sky, so to speak, and both countries would have been wiped out. This is the old Cold War strategy. We let the Russians know about it. That's the important thing. We let them know that if they launched against us, there would be no hesitation, or an automatic launch back, and both countries would lay in ruins. Well, you know, those days kind of gone, I guess. I don't know with Putin, maybe they're not, but you know, we're now afraid of terrorism, Islamic terrorism and other kinds of terrorism. And we're afraid of a nuke getting into the hands of a terrorist in Washington, D.C. or New York or Chicago or L.A. being the victim of a nuclear terror attack with a suitcase bomb. These bombs are relatively small, not much bigger than a steamer trunk. And they pack the same wallop as a Hiroshima-type bomb or a Nagasaki-type bomb. So, you know, the book, my book postulates that we have notified the world, especially the Islamic world, and that if a nuclear device went off in an American city, we would retaliate with nuclear missiles against a number of cities in the world of Islam. And that they would not, you know, there would be a price to pay, a very high price to pay for a nuclear attack. Well, the problem with that is you don't know where the nuclear bomb came from that went off in Chicago or New York or L.A. And what you're saying is that you're going to destroy a good part of the Mideast. So in my book, I said maybe a program like this should exist, not meaning that we want to nuke the Middle East, but that we need to put people on notice. I think we went through 40 years of Cold War without a nuclear war between the Soviet Union and America because both sides totally understood what the consequences were. And both sides were rational enough not to start a nuclear war. I grew up in the 50s, and I remember we were just terrified of Russian nuclear missiles landing on New York and America. But as the American government became more adamant about what we were going to do, I think the chances of a nuclear war lessened to the extent where it was unthinkable. And I'm afraid we don't have that kind of, warning to people who would consider nuclear weapons. We need to warn them that there are bad things that are going to happen. Not because we want to nuke them, but because we want nobody to nuke anybody. So, I mean, it's a strategy, it's a psychology, and it's been talked about in government, but never really verbalized. So that's what the book was about, and some people found it a little bit scary, and some people didn't like the concept. and other people did. So that's what books do, though. That's what novels do. They make
people. Yeah, just for people listening, just in a sentence or two, basically an elite group of American, I guess you'd say, businessmen had a secretive little group, and they devised a plan to nuke two major American cities to make it look like it was a terrorist attack, so that there would be a massive launch of on the Mideast, the Arab Islamic world in the Mideast. And you know, you could see such a thing existing. That's the incredible part of it. And God, yeah, you just hope nothing like that ever even comes close to happening.
Right. I mean, that's the fertile mind of a fertile imagination of an author. But the scary thing is that a lot of these nuclear, suitcase-sized nukes that were made in the Soviet Union are missing, and they can't seem to account for them, and nobody knows where they are.
Yeah.
And this is not good.
So no.
When the Soviet Union collapsed, they lost control of a lot of their nuclear weapons, because many of them were in countries that now fell outside the you know, the Russian Federation, like Kazakhstan and other places where there was a lot of Russian nukes, and they didn't clean up their the room before they left, and they, the Russians pulled out, and the inventory was not well kept, which is scary.
Yeah. As I went on with your books, I tried to read them mostly in order, although I was out of order with a couple of them, but I got to John Sutter, and I read The Gold Coast, and I just had so much fun with that book because, as people who have read it know, an upscale Wall Street lawyer who lives in a very wealthy part, the Gold Coast of Long Island, with his wealthy wife, and moving in next door is a mafia don, Frank Della Rosa, who at first they're appalled by, but who they get very involved with. And I was born to Italian immigrant parents, and we were brought up with so many of the things you mentioned in that book, like the Italian customs, going to the Italian restaurant, and that one scene you had where John Sutter is in, I guess it was Little Italy, in an Italian restaurant, and Frank keeps eating course after course after course.
Right.
It was so funny, and I just related to so many of the things, especially that part, which the recurring refrain in the book, every time Frank said something, capiche, capiche, you know.
Well, I grew up like that, too. I grew up in Jamaica, Queens, and my mother's Italian, and my father is part Italian, but part French. He's from Canada, and that's where the name DeMille comes from. But, I grew up in an Italian neighborhood in Jamaica, Queens, and then moved to Long Island. But the neighborhood I moved into, Long Island, was a lot of people from the city, who were Italian. So the Italian immigrant culture was very strong back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, kind of waning now as the years go by, but I grew up with, aunts and uncles. Some of them didn't speak English, and some of them, even the ones that did, were, some born in Italy but came here at a very young age. So that was my background. I didn't ever use it in a book, and, when I just conceived of the Gold Coast, I said, this is a chance for me to get some of my Italian heritage into a book. And it was kind of fun. I had fun with it.
Oh, it was, I just got such a kick out of that. And how did you get, like, I don't know, like they sort of were concurrent, John Corey and Sutter as well, because there were the Corey books, around that time. But how did you get to the idea of a John Sutter type character?
Well, the kind of people I know, I only live here on Long Island now. I do not live on the Gold Coast, which is very wealthy, but we know people up there. And, every once in a while I get invited to a party or a fundraiser, and it's kind of an interesting world. You know, the world of the old, old WASP, and so some of whom were very wealthy, and some of whom just had, old family names but didn't have any money. I mean, John Sutter in my book really doesn't have any money. But he's, of course, got the right education, and that's much more important in an old culture like you find on the Gold Coast of Long Island. It doesn't matter how much money you have. It really doesn't. It really matters, did you go to Yale? Did you go to Harvard? Did you go to, for prep school? Did you go to St. Paul's? So that was John Sutter. His wife came from a family that had a lot of money, but they weren't that old a family. Kind of new money almost, and So there was two things going on there. Old money and new money, or this old family and new money. Then you had the Mafia Don. So it was kind of an examination of that little microcosm, a little bit of America on the Gulf Coast of Long Island. And of course, I was inspired a little bit by The Great Gatsby.
Okay. Well, just one more point about that book, which I have to say, because it brought back a memory from when I was a kid. When I was a kid, and we'd get together for aunts and uncles and my family and all the aunts and uncles of my parents, all from Italy, and we'd have the Christmas and New Year's and all that. My aunt, one time, when I was maybe 10 years old, she was saying, "Oh yeah, you remember the cheese with the worms in it?" I thought, like, this can't be true. And I saw it in a book. You had that exact dish that Frank was eating in the restaurant.
Right. Actually, you can't even buy that this year. I think it's illegal now. But yeah, you still can find it. I mean, I still go to Little Italy, and there's not much left of Little Italy in Manhattan. But there's the restaurants are still there, and I have older relatives, and they import sometimes stuff directly from Italy. And one of the things is, although I haven't seen it in a while, is the cheese with the worms in it. But I think the FDA has now banned that, but that's all right.
Yeah, I could see that. Moving on to another book of really favorite of mine, and when I saw how long it was, they read at the beginning how many hours it is and that sort of thing, I said, wow, this is going to be some undertaking. Upcountry, when you talk about Paul Brenner being given an assignment to go back to Vietnam, and right, there was a guy with a secret and all that sort of thing. And I said, wow, can I get through this book? And I just was so gripped by that book. The interplay between Paul Brenner and the woman expatriate, Susan Weber, and that extensive trip they took, the dialogue between them. I mean, that was just so absolutely fascinating to read that book and how it developed, especially with the, what was his name, Colonel Mang, the Vietnam military guy.
Yeah, that was that book came about because I went back to Vietnam in '97 with two other guys, friends who had served there, and I went there to write a magazine article. Somebody asked me to do a magazine, a travel magazine, which doesn't exist anymore. But I knew that there was a book there. I just didn't know what the book was going to be, and I was there and originally with the U.S. government, the U.S. Army, all expenses paid, 1967, 68, and I was there for the Tet Offensive, and I spent a little over a year in Vietnam, and then 30 years later, I was asked to go back and do a travel article on Vietnam, and I found the place was totally different. I mean, 30 years had gone by, and there was still memories of the war, and a lot of destruction still, and I said, there's a book here, and I just didn't know what it was, and then I took my character of Paul Brenner from The General's Daughter. I don't know, Richard, you ever see the movie General's Daughter with John Travolta?
No, I missed that. After I read your book, I said, well, I have to see this movie.
Yeah, and the movie, kind of captured the book. It wasn't a bad movie. Character was good of Paul Brenner. So I used him in an Upcountry, and so that wasn't so much a sequel as it was just, another story. But it came about mostly because of my trip. And my trip to Vietnam, my civilian trip, kind of followed that book, starting in Saigon and moving upcountry and winding up in Hanoi. It was a good fight for me and the other guys who went on the trip. It was good, good catharsis and good closure on a lot of things. I think we put a lot of it behind us on that trip. It was good to see the country at peace and to see that so many children had been born before the war, and some of these kids are weren't even kids. I mean, they're in their 20s and 30s, had a very little memory or no memory of the war. So it was a country at peace, and that was good for us to see. And I think I tried to capture that in Upcountry, and hopefully I did.
Yeah, I would say you definitely did. My one question about it is Colonel Mang, if I still recall his name correctly, he still had a lot of hostility and anger about the war and toward Brenner. Are there people still like that in Vietnam?
Probably not now, but you know, then, yes, 1997 when I went back, there was a lot of hostility. The South Vietnamese, of course, were different. They were our allies, but after the South was defeated, after we left Vietnam, by North Vietnam, a lot of what they called carpetbaggers came from the North to be administrators and to kind of run the conquered half of the country. And many of them were, it's not all of them that lost somebody in the war. I mean, over a million Vietnamese were killed, North Vietnamese were killed during the war. So everybody had lost somebody. And of course, in the South, they lost a million or so people. So it was a country that, not a large population to begin with, 20 million in the North, 20 million in the South. So everybody had somebody who was either died or, you know, severely injured. So you did have the hostility. We saw the hostility. And but then we saw, you know, also a lot of South Vietnamese Army veterans who had fought alongside the Americans who were very friendly to us on the street. There are two different things going on. Sort of like the war between the North and the South in America. You know, the North won, and the South was conquered. And we saw that the older people, especially, still had good feelings about the Americans if they lived in the South. In the North, it was different. And then we got up to Hanoi, and in Hanoi, there was a lot of hostility. Mm-hmm. We actually left Hanoi a couple of days early because it was really uncomfortable. So, and I think I hopefully captured that in the book, too.
Yeah, that whole thing with Mang, the interplay between Mang and Brenner was really fascinating, and it went throughout pretty much the whole book, and it was really a great byplay on the book.
We had a bus driver when I was there in 97, he was of that age, so we said, you know, and he spoke okay English. Asked him if he had, you know, we didn't know what side he'd fought on, but he was a North Vietnamese. And he said to me, it was one of the funnier lines of the trip of these two other guys, he said to us, well, maybe we meet in 1968. And I said to him, if we'd met in 1968, only one of us would be here.
Yeah.
And he kind of got that.
Wow. Well, just in the last couple minutes here, some of the members, I had asked them to send in some questions, and some of them you've already answered, but here's one from the person I mentioned to you earlier before we came on here, one of your biggest fans, Cheryl in Florida. She wanted to know, how long did it take you to write your first book? Now, I know from an interview you said that you were writing some early paperbacks when you really weren't well known, and then you got an agent and you started to get into the big time writing. So let's talk about the latter part where, you know, you were had an agent and you were with a publisher and all that. How long did your first book take you to write?
The first book, the first hardcover would have been By the Rivers of Babylon. It was published in 78. It took about 14 months to write, and most of my books are around 14 months. I feel comfortable with that schedule. Some of them have been longer, 16 months. And, you know, I know authors like Jim Patterson and who can do a book every 6 months. And so, you know, everybody has their own speed, I guess. And but, you know, a book that needs to be researched is not just pure fiction. Between the research and the writing and the vetting and the editing, and then research, you know, consists of what I call library research, which we kind of do online now. Then there's interviews, when you interview people like jet pilots, for instance, or airline pilots, or doctors. You need to interview these people to see what their world is. And then the third kind of research is, you know, the field research. And I went to Vietnam and I went to Moscow to write my book, The Charm School, and, you know, I've been all over the world. That's kind of the fun part of the research. You go around the world and research the places you've been. My current book is set in Cuba, and I was in Cuba last October, not this past October, the October before. And I began the book then, and now I'm about to finish it, so that's about 14, 15 months. So, you know, other writers write kind of, not just fiction, but kind of fantasy fiction, where you can kind of make up your own world, but my stuff is all grounded in the real world, so I need to do my research. So 14, 16 months is a good schedule for me.
Well, that's certainly a substantial period of your life each time. Now, a couple of people were concerned about the apparent breakup between Corey and his wife. And can you shed any light on that?
Well, the new book that's set in Cuba is not a John Corey book. I'm giving John a break. And I got so much feedback about the breakup between John Corey and his wife, the apparent breakup, we're not quite sure what's happening, that appears in the book that she's having an affair. And a lot of women did not like Kate Mayfield, John Corey's wife. I was very surprised. Actually, I knew that from fan letters over the years. They wanted John Corey to themselves, I think, you know. And a lot of women were happy that Kate Mayfield was having an affair and out of the picture. But guys, maybe, I don't know, guys more romantic or more sentimental, they wanted John to get back with his wife. And, you know, which is what I'm going to do. I don't always tell everybody, but I'll tell everybody.
Oh, okay.
I want to bring them back together. They need to come back together. They were a good team. And I'm not so stupid as to take a formula for success and mess with it too much. So the next John Corey book will be a lot about their reconciliation, which I think will be a kind of an interesting and important part of the book while they're working on a case. So it puts a little bit more tension between them, and that kind of works in a literary way.
That's yeah, I could see how that would be interesting to develop. There's a John Corey TV show coming up?
Yes, I'm almost positive of it. You never know what's happening in TV land and Hollywood land or anything that happens out on the West Coast. We're always up in the air about what they're going to do. But Sony TV, who owns the John Corey character, so to speak, has made a deal with ABC TV to make a pilot film on John Corey. And I believe what they're going to do is use the first John Corey book, which was Plum Island. So the pilot will be Plum Island, I'm pretty sure. And if everything goes well, it will be this coming fall. It will be aired on ABC TV.
Wow, that's very exciting. I certainly don't want to miss that. And just in closing, you might find this amusing, but I do. That Debbie from Arizona, who happens to be our president, and Mike from North Carolina, another one of our prominent members, they say, ask him whether he would consider including in one of his novels a blind person, perhaps even a romantic interest for Corey, and maybe even name it Debbie. What do you think of that?
That would be a challenge. A good friend of mine is a police officer here in Nassau County, actually a police, I guess official you'd say, is dating and has dated for a long time a blind woman, and I know her, and I know them both, obviously. And, you know, it's a beautiful relationship, and they don't see any, any really, there are hurdles, obviously, we know that. And I knew another couple whose wedding I participated in, who were both blind. And, I kind of understand that world. We all know blind people, and, you know. But I always feel that I'm always afraid as a novelist that I'm getting it wrong when I create different ethnic groups or different people who are differently abled, so to speak. And also, when I'm creating a female character, I'm afraid I'm getting it wrong. So I have my wife read it, and I have my assistant read it, and my editor's female, so they kind of vet me on that. It's interesting. And you know, when I first heard from you guys and asked me if I do this interview, I had the same thought myself that I should have a blind person in one of my books. It would be interesting, and if I felt confident that I could get it right, I would certainly do it.
Yeah, every once in a while I come across a book in a mainstream, you know, novel, and they have a blind person in there, and you know, it's kind of interesting to see how they portray him. Well, I want to thank you so much for this. This, we all really thank you. Someone of your prominence and great talent to come on and spend some time with us is absolutely fantastic, and we really,
my
really
pleasure,
appreciate
Richard,
it.
And happy birthday.
Thank you very much, and good luck with your next book and the TV show.
Thanks so much.
Take care.